Yeah, the same for Jewel. Last night I thought I must sit down and sort out these notes that are scribbled and see if I can knit them together to give something a bit coherent tonight. But that's not what I actually did. I ended up watching an episode of Middlemarch that my lovely friend Trish Vantra lent me. She lent me a whole pile of DVDs a while ago. I'm working my way through. I was watching a particular episode of Middlemarch. I don't know if you know it. One of the great books of English literature by George Eliot. And in it, the bit I was watching, I love this little interaction, is where these two women are in they're at a wedding in the churchyard, and they're commenting on the bridegroom, who's a foreigner, right? Basically, he moved into this rather provincial town. And one of them says, you know, well, he's a stranger, isn't he? He's, you know, she was a bit scathing about him, he's a stranger. But the other said, well, are we not told we should entertain strangers and welcome them and be hospitable and make them feel at home? And the first one says, I was not speaking in a religious sense, Harriet. And I love that bit, I think, partly because it's such an astute observation of human nature by George Eliot. But I really love that bit because also what it shows is about how we can have, you know, ideas about what is right and what is a good thing to do, and then, you know, what really happens in daily life, what is our actual practice. Anyway, that so in a funny way, I came to the Sangha through Middlemarch last night. And I was thinking back to when Sangharakshita came to England, you know, after he'd been in India. And he came back to England and found that there was not really that much going on in terms of Buddhism here in England, in London. And that the actual Buddhist society at the time was quite I think he coins it as an armchair affair, where people would, you know, talk about these things, but not particularly put it into practice so much. And he saw that there was a real cause for, well, a new Buddhist movement. And that was how he started our movement. He founded our order and our movement in 1967, was it?
Yeah.
When I was five, or four. yeah. And he started it because he could see there was a real need for a more alive experience of the Dharma, a real life sort of putting it into practice, what we learn about the Dharma. And I think as a result of his vision at that time, like, we now have a very thriving Sangha, you know, in the Triratna movement, a real thriving Sangha. And I think particularly here at the LBC, that is very evident. You know, we have, like tonight, there's all of you, but every evening here there's a class that is very well attended, there's lots of people, there are many, many activities, there's lots going on, and people are involved in various ways. You know, some of you may have come along just recently, or maybe it's your first time. Some of you have been coming around for a long time, for many years. But we're all part of this Sangha, this Triratna Mahasangha, and that is part of our practice. So what Sangharakshita, what he wanted to bring out, and what he has brought out, is that, like, what unites us, you know, what is it that is important for us as Buddhists, not just here, but anywhere in the world, what is it, what's the central point for us, you know, what is our central practice? And he said, well, actually, what's central and what ought to be central for any Buddhist is one's going for refuge. One's going for refuge to the three jewels, to the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. And that is what unites, you know, in a way, all Buddhists across the world, no matter What form maybe that Buddhism takes, or what school people may be part of. And as a result, here we are today, part of his vision manifest. But what does it mean? What does the Sangha mean, and what does it mean to go for refuge to it? And going for refuge means really to commit oneself to it, to see the value in it, and therefore committing oneself to it, so that what you think has value, you hold dear, as it were, you want to put into practice, or you want to bring alive for yourself in your life, you want to make real for yourself. And that's what going for refuge is, it's commitment, it's committing oneself. Now, I don't know how you became involved in Buddhism, but sometimes we say people can become involved through different jewels. Some people become involved more through the Buddha jewel, or the Dharma jewel, or the Sangha jewel. And when I went to this retreat Shupa mentioned in 1988, I certainly felt very attracted to the Sangha jewel there. There was this retreat, there were all these people who I didn't know a soul there. But there was something about them that I found inspiring, because they seemed all very ordinary, but at the same time very open. And there was this sense of very honest communication that I was really struck by and loved, actually. I loved that. That communication that was there, that whole atmosphere there of the Sangha. But to go for refuge to it, or to commit oneself, it takes vision, doesn't it? It takes imagination of what it can really be, and what you can really be. In terms of the Buddha jewel, like what you can become, you know, that you can actually overcome or transcend your own habitual tendencies, that you can overcome that the Dharma is there to help us, to inform us, to teach us, like how do we walk that path. And of course the Sangha is there to support and inspire us, and for us to support and inspire each other. Now, Sangha actually exists on different levels, and traditionally there are three levels of Sangha that we go for refuge to. There is first of all the Arya Sangha, Arya meaning noble, those of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, you know, the enlightened beings that in a way are, well, the ideal of enlightenment, as they say in the puja, to which we aspire, that what we can become, that what we can grow into or grow towards. And what I like about that is that there's something in there for everyone. You know, so in that way, the Buddha and the Sangha jewel also sort of overlap, you know, because it's the Buddha jewel, but it's also the Sangha jewel. You also go for refuge to the Sangha in there. It's a bit like enlightenment being like a very bright white light that you almost can't see into because it's too blinding. And if you would hold the prism in front of a white light, what happens is the light breaks into many different colors and would come out in different facets through that prism. I don't know if you... I used to do that in science class. I don't know if you did that sort of thing in school. And every Bodhisattva, Buddha, has different colors, and I think they're all aspects of the same thing, aspects of that same, you know, bright white light, that enlightenment. But it makes it somehow a bit more easy for us to relate to, because they might embody compassion or wisdom or you know, different qualities of enlightenment that we can relate to personally. And that's like a way in towards that ideal of that enlightenment. Makes it almost a bit more accessible for us. So that's the first level of Sangha that we can commit to, that we can go for refuge to. And the second one, traditionally, is in traditional Buddhist countries, the bhikkhus or bhikkhunis, you know, the monks and nuns sangha. Nowadays, there's a lot of, it's not always as beautiful as it may seem, you know, in many countries, unfortunately, there's a lot of corruption, even in the, even in that sort of sangha. But traditionally, those were also the ones you would go for refuge to, monks and nuns, people who in a way had attained higher states of mind, higher levels of consciousness. So people that could inspire us or could maybe be an example to us. And then finally there is the Mahasangha, or the Sangha as we know it here. So anyone who is involved in the Sangha here, and that may be from people, like I said, who've just become just involved, to people who've been around for a long time, who've done decades of meditation, people who've maybe gained stream entry, just, you know, a level of development that you cannot fall back from, cannot fall back to your old self. And what we're trying to create, especially in Tri Ratna movement, is what Sangha actually also calls the new society. You know, he had this vision of what it could be like, what it would be like if, as a Sangha, as people together, we practice meditation. We have these three levels of practice. You know, there's ethics, you know, our precepts that we practice. There's meditation, there's wisdom. Those three areas of training, rather. That if we practice that, we would all basically become better human beings, or better able to create that kind of sangha. And I think often that is already evident. I find often in the center here, or Buddhist gatherings, I feel that the level of communication, maybe the level of honesty, is such that, you know, I don't really know where else I would find that outside. I do find that often quite extraordinary. And how can you be a friend to one another? You know, because I think that the Sangha is about friendship. What else is it about if not friendship? The Buddha said friendship was the whole of the spiritual life. I'm sure you've heard that more than once, sort of often quoted. And it is, because we really, really need each other. We cannot really grow alone, as it were. It's hard to do that. It's almost impossible to do that. So we need each other. We need each other to inspire us, to support us also when things are tough, when things are difficult. That's where friends come in. And I feel very fortunate myself that you know, through my 22 years of involvement now in this movement, that I've developed a number of friendships over the years, and quite a few of them from living with people. You know, when I first came here, I lived in community for about 10 years. And I think the people I've lived with, I just made a connection with, and they weren't necessarily people I liked. They weren't necessarily people I would normally have got together with, even. But because we lived together, we were just thrown in together, and because we all had this shared ideal of wanting to practice the Dharma, wanting to, well, grow and develop and have that as a shared ideal, we found areas where, you know, we would, yeah, come together, even though we might be very different characters. I think some of these people have become very good friends, and I would never have thought that. And it's so interesting, because you don't always know. I mean, in fact, you don't really know each other, really. you have a certain impression maybe of someone, but you don't really know someone else ever, really. There's always more. So it's about, the Sangha is about, it's not so much about that you have to agree with each other, you know, that you all have to be on the same line, but it's actually, it's about going beyond likes or dislikes of each other. So not so much gravitating to just the little clan of people that you like, but actually taking an interest in other people as much. That's what makes the Sangha thrive, and that's what makes it grow. So it's a gathering of people who share the ideal, or the common spiritual ideal. And nowadays, I can sound old actually, but when I was not that long involved, there was much more talk of Kalyana Mitrata. And I don't know how much you hear of that now, where Kalyana Mitra is about, it's about friendship with people who you feel are maybe a bit more further along the way than you, who've got a bit more experience, who you know, have been practicing for longer, and who can be an inspiration to you. And there was a time when lots of people had or formed Kalyana Mitratas in that way with people. I don't hear it so much now, if it's still the case. I think it's a great great way of practicing, great way of developing friendships. I have two, you know, that's traditionally the case. I have two Kalyana Mitras. And they're very good friends. They will be friends, you know, all my life. And we may not always have contact that much, but we just know of each other. We're there for each other. And they inspire me. Always have inspired me in many ways. And it's, you know, after a while, it's not so much a vertical or a one-way thing. It's very much a mutual inspiration. And I'd say all my friendships are that. We can inspire each other, and when the chips are down for me, then it's great to know that I've got good friends, and I'm very fortunate. And that's really through the Sangha. It's I feel very fortunate that way. Because with your friends, you know each other. You know each other well. You know what your working ground is. You know what each other's working ground is. Where, you know, where the difficulties lie. Where people, you know, where you get hooked somehow. Where you sort of trip up every time. You know, your particular thing. We all have our particular thing, don't we? I have my particular thing. My particular thing. Well, one of them. Is that I can feel disengaged. You know, I can disconnect. And then I think, friends? What friends? And then a friend might drop by, and then that dissolves again, because I start to feel connected again with myself, and then with this friend I feel, oh yeah, actually no, that's there. I just temporarily I lose touch with that level of connection that is actually always there, but I forget sometimes, or I lose sight of it occasionally. And that's my particular thing that, you know, comes round from time to time. Oh, I'm here again. All right, okay. And that's why my friends always help me out, always inspire me, support me, and occasionally sort of laugh at me. They say, don't be so ridiculous. Because they know me and love me, and that is what makes it work. That is what makes it work. Yeah. I think in the Sangha, the wider Sangha, I think we all have an effect on each other. And I was talking about that to someone the other day, like how even if we're not together, necessarily, we still have an effect on each other. Even if there are people who are part of our Buddhist Sangha, maybe not the LBC Sangha, but the wider movement, who live, you know, in faraway places, maybe quite in isolated places where they don't really have access to a centre or friends nearby. And there are quite a few people like that, but they are practitioners, you know, they practice the Dharma. And I'm always aware of them, and I always feel that connection with them. And somehow it's really important for me that they are there. So it's not so much that you all need to be in one room together, but it's that sense of connection of people who practice. We're somehow all in the same boat. And when we meditate, or even when we don't meditate, this thing about your mind, well, it's not, you know, you can be in like small mind, can't you? And then something that can shift where you feel you're in a sort of more fluid space. And when is it still your mind and when is it just mind? You know, and there's some level where we're all very connected, very, very interconnected, even if we're not aware of that. And therefore what we do or how we practice has an effect on everybody else, always has an effect. And that's always also how we can support each other. Yeah, the mind is not an individual thing, it's much bigger than that, it's bigger than us, bigger than ourselves. And we have an effect on each other, and hopefully a good effect on each other. Because the Buddha said at the end of his life, he said to be a lamp unto yourself. You know, he advised you to be a lamp unto yourself. He never said be an island unto yourself. Huh? He said be a lamp unto yourself. So also be discerning, like choose who in the way you associate with. Who your friends are, you know, you can also choose your friends, you can choose wisely. And that used to sort of irk me a little bit, because I thought, well, shouldn't you be friends with everybody? And but actually, there's a wisdom in finding friends that, you know, support you and inspire you, and if you want to grow and develop, you choose your friends wisely, or you associate with people that would inspire you. Not only, but, you know, it's a large part of it. And also, I was going to say the thing about Sangha in the Triratna order, Triratna movement. It's really quite special, because there are many other Buddhist groups or many other Buddhist practitioners, but I don't know any where Sangha plays such a pivotal, important role, is so important as a practice and it's so alive to people. And I know of some people who, you know, have been involved here and get disenchanted maybe with being in this particular movement, and, you know, people leave. Yeah, they do, of course, and go somewhere else. But very often, when I see them again, they may not necessarily want to come back, but often what they say, what they miss the Sangha, because they may have found something else in this other group or Buddhist movement, but what they always miss is, seems to be the Sangha, that friendship that we have here. I can't quite emphasize enough how particular it is and how special it is. And I really, really value it. So yes, Kalyana Mitrata, important to be an inspiration to our friends. And also to be clear about what it is we're heading for, what it is we want, what our goal is really in our spiritual life. I was reading a bit in Sangharakshita's book, What is the Sangha? And he recalls an interview with, who was it? Swami Ram Das, a guru who died in the 60s, and he was asked why people take up a spiritual life and regularly make so little progress, because that seemed to be the case. And he said, well, there were two reasons for that. One was that there wasn't really a clear goal, and there wasn't really a clear path or a clear way of how to get to that goal. And of course, if you don't know where you're going, or you don't know how to go where you, you know, how to go anywhere, then it's hard to make progress. And I thought, again, we're very fortunate in the teaching of Sangharakshita Bhante. His teachings are so clear. They're so clear. There's nothing vague about it. So we don't have to be vague. We don't need to be vague at all. It's in a way so much easier now, especially there's so many books, so many things we can learn, so many things we can be involved in around the center, not just classes but groups and study groups and retreats, women retreats, weekend coming up next week. There's so many things where we can get involved and be involved in Sangha and create a Sangha again together. On the last winter retreat I was on, I wanted to introduce something different in terms of work rotas, and inspired by the Dutch Sangha, I have to say, I introduced the no rota. So we had no rota. We just said, well, you know, just do what needs doing. Like, we're all here on retreat, and this is a Sangha, and just, you know, if you see something needs doing, just do it. And of course, that people come up against all sorts of things then, because, well, there are people who always see everything that needs doing, and therefore, you know, see that no one else is doing it, so therefore immediately rush to do it all, and work very hard to do it all. And there are, of course, those people who, you know, never really notice when the bin needs emptying, or other things need doing, or don't really think things are particularly dirty yet. So that in itself is quite a practice, and I thought it was quite an interesting practice for people to do, because you come up against your own tendencies, and it's an opportunity to work with it. So I was encouraging people, if you were, you know, the sort of do it all, the very capable person who always steps in and does it all, or maybe, you know, step back and just let other people, give them that chance or that opportunity. Or if you were someone who, you know, never really just think, oh, right, okay, no rota, I'm off. you know, it's an opportunity. Now, there were some people who did that, you know, who just thought, right, okay, I never saw them do anything. But that, anyway, that was all right too, you know, that's just what they wanted to do, and I suppose you come up against yourself in whatever way. I thought it was quite a good practice, rather than have something prescribed and then feeling that you have to do this now every day. So it created more of a spontaneous action, Sangha. Although I was a bit worried the first day. I was in the kitchen, I thought, what? It's 9:15 and no one is washing up. So I immediately started washing up. And then someone said to me, what do I do? No one's washing up. They're all sitting there chatting away, you know, after breakfast. And someone said to me, well, you know, you've got to give them a chance. And I thought, it's true. And I just thought, I step back, see what happens. And of course, it just got done. And I thought it was a real coming together of Sangha, and I really enjoy that. I really enjoy that on retreat, where you have that, you know, people just do it. They just act spontaneously. And I love that. But yeah, we need to keep our vision alive for Sangha, or our vision of, you know, what we can become, because it's not just about being, well, chummy and friends and being together. It's all great, of course. But it's not about that, because really the spiritual life is about Well, it's about self-transcendence, isn't it? It's about transforming ourselves. It's about overcoming our particular habits of a lifetime and working with our particular conditioning. And that's different for each of us. But very rewarding if we make some little progress with that. And so fantastic when people support us in that work that we all do, that we can do. So we find the inspirations and keep our ideal in mind, and we need our imagination for that. It's sometimes easy to lose faith. It's sometimes easy to, well, just maybe see it as a social club. But to remember that what we're here for is to actually, is quite something, you know. It's not just any old club that we join. What's different? I was talking about that today with someone. Like, what makes the Sangha different from another group, perhaps, where, you know, you also come together and support each other and wash up together? I thought the difference is about having this spiritual ideal, having this ideal of, you know, transformation, what we can become, that we don't have to, in a way that we not really are who we think we are, almost. And that through our imagination, we can imagine what would it be like to be really free, to be really spontaneous in our action all the time. I mean, we'd be bodhisattvas if we were like that. And imagine if we were all like that. You know, there would be this amazing flow of energy, just no problem, no row. Yeah. And I think we can become that more and more. And I think as a Sangha, we've really matured so much as well over the years. Really matured a lot. And there are now many people in Sangha who've practiced for so long. So we've got that experience, that kind of maturity. And it's so inspiring. I think it's very inspiring to have that. And inspiring to see so many new people come through our doors. You know, young people and... because the Dharma is always so timeless, and who connect again with people here, connect with people at classes, on retreat, make that connection, and then want to give of oneself. I just see so many examples of that, where people give of oneself. And I think a great example of that was last month when we had the fashion show that Jack was very involved in. And it was just such a coming together of so many people and such incredibly hard work that went on. I hadn't quite realized how much hard work was involved in that, actually, until I got there. But so many people were involved in, you know, organizing this whole thing as a fundraiser for Vajrasana. And it was such a fun evening and very successful, and a really successful fundraising. I thought, that's what, as a Sangha, that's what we can do. And we can always do more than that, you know. It's amazing. People have ideas. Just had an email the other day from Jane wanting to cycle to Vajrasana and get some people roped in. Again, as a fundraiser. It's like one person has this idea. And, you know, send out an email, like, who wants to? And, like, that's, again, it's something we can all connect over and all be inspired by and do. And I think that's fantastic. Just have that idea, have that imagination. What can I do? Sounds a bit like John F. Kennedy now. Don't think what your Sangha do for you, think what you can do for your Sangha. Yeah. Well, we can do loads. We can do loads. And I was reading this bit in the Mahapana. Long word, Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the last weeks of the Buddha's life. And he has quite a long discourse on the Sangha, like, you know, how to meet as a Sangha, how to meet harmoniously, skillful speech, you know, and that if you meet in large numbers and you meet regularly, that you know, you stand strong, there's not a lot you can do. And I also came across this bit that I thought was a bit funny. He said, the growth of the bhikkhus is to be expected, not their decline, bhikkhus, so long as they do not delight in, are not pleased with, and are not fond of activities, talk, sleep, and company. That was just that bit that struck me. Because I thought, how fond we are of activities, or activity, and how fond we are of always doing things. Because that can often make us feel useful, or gives us some sort of identity that we can do things, that we can be active. And it's something we can be good at. And what is our value if we just sit there and we don't engage in particular activities? And it still has intrinsic value, but it's harder, it's a practice. I practice just sitting there. I get bored, of course, at times, but I still practice it, because I realize that why I get bored is because that I'm always thinking I ought to be doing something. I'm sitting here now, but I ought to be doing something. And when I just let go of that thought and I just sit there, that's peace. They're small moments. But I like to think they could grow. Anyway, that's a bit about the Sangha and how I enjoy it and how I feel very much part of it on the whole when I'm not in my disconnected, disengaged state, and to keep it alive. And for some that's easier than others, because I think some people are better at having imagination or thinking very positively or thinking big, you know, just thinking big. And I can tend to think, well, you know, I tend to think to see what goes wrong. What might just not work, for instance. And I think it's a real pitfall, because it's quite a challenge to really just think about how amazing something can be, or how amazing a Sangha can be, how amazing we can be together. And what if we don't get on? You know, what if there are difficulties? What if communication isn't always that great? Because of course that happens. And I think we all have the potential to grow and develop. And I like to always bear that in mind, you know, that we all have the potential. Not only that potential, but if we're all in this Sangha, that is what we're striving towards, each of us. And I think if there's a breakdown in communication or difficulty, to still bear that in mind, that actually this other person, you know, still, you know, is striving towards greater harmony, greater you know, growth and development, wanting to support or inspire, and that I never feel it's a closed book in that way, that there's always an opportunity again. And sometimes that may take time, but I feel there's always an opportunity. Because we can see the potential in others as much as we can see the potential in ourselves. And that's where Sangha is also special. Not to see it as a closed group. So our Sangha is what's called an effective Sangha. It's an effective Sangha. It's not quite a real Sangha. A real Sangha is a Sangha where people are stream entrants or have gained that level of attainment. And of course there are people in our movement who are stream entrants. How do you know? Who are they? Well, it takes one to know one, doesn't it? Not that I am one. But when I host school visits occasionally here, I get these primary school groups, and that's always the question you get. Are you enlightened? Or can you fly? Or do you know anyone who is enlightened? And you know, you don't really, because it's true, to know one, you know, you got to be one to know one in a way. And then if you are, it's probably not something you would necessarily talk about. And what does it matter anyway? But of course we do know, we do all know people who we find inspiring, or whose conduct is inspiring, or, you know, who we can see, they're just chipping away at things. You know, it may not always be easy, but they're chipping away at it, and they're making progress, and they're steady in their practice. Or even when they're not necessarily that steady in their practice, there's something about them that we feel is inspiring. And it's really great to know that there are people who are very earnestly striving towards stream entry, because Bhante says we can all attain that in our lifetime, which is quite something. And I wonder sometimes how seriously we take that. Mm-hmm. That we think, well, yeah, that's all right for so and so, but little me. No, no. But if he says it's possible, you know, he wouldn't say that lightly. It means that it's possible. And I often think about that. But it means that I'd really have to give up certain things, or work, or look at certain aspects of myself that I may not particularly want to look at right now. And I have to be honest about that, you know, that is not really where, what I'm doing, or it's not quite what I want to be very conscious of right now. But it is possible. And I think if we would be a sangha of stream entrance, how amazing that would be. Can you imagine it though? Can you? Yeah, you're laughing, but can you imagine it? Or is it just like, no? But that's what we're working towards. That's what we're working towards. Yeah, and to give of ourselves in that, and to become more of an individual rather than the individualist. Yeah. To really be able to know what your values are, and really you know, that you hold dear, that you really think, well, you respect it somehow. You know, when there's something you really value, you have a respect for it. And you want to act in accordance with it. And I think when you can do that, you know, you become more of an individual. And maybe until that point we're a bit more individualists, where we maybe look a bit more about what they do, and therefore we do something else. Individualist, you look more to others in order to act differently from everyone. So that may look very individual, but is it really? Where does it come from? So if we're truly informed by the Dharma, then it comes out of ourselves, doesn't it? And it's just an expression of who we are. And we're all different in how we express ourselves. Yeah, and becoming an individual, that means we need to see through our own limited self-view. You know, that's one of the first fetters to break. To break down our habit, our particular view of ourselves, and that we so believe in it. Just as when I feel disengaged and I think, you know, nobody loves me. It's a view I have, and the thing is, you know, I can see I've got better at it over time, that I now know when I have that view, that is a view. Whereas many years ago, I would believe it, you know. And that's where the progress lies, that's where the growth is. So now I know it's a view. That's how you sort of slowly loosen that up a little bit. And to let go of our old self is, that's what this year, the year of spiritual death, that's what it is, to let go of our old self, to let go of, you know, who we think we are, who we in some ways don't really want to be any longer, or that holds us back, or that's keeping us down somewhere. And in a way, we're just doing it ourselves. So to make room for the new, the old has to go, and spiritual death is necessary. You know, it's a necessary condition for growth. Otherwise, we cannot grow. We have to let go. And I think one of the hallmarks of an effective sangha as well is truth. You know, being truthful in communication and honest, and it always having to be on the basis of metta. You know, any kind of feedback that my friends may give me or I may give to friends, you know, ideally it would be always based on metta. We used to have this term called fierce friendship, which sometimes, I don't know if some of you remember that, fierce friendship. It was about, you know, saying to people sometimes that, you know, just telling them how it was, as it were, but in a way that would be helpful. And sometimes that could turn into a bit of criticism or unkind feedback. But if it's not based in metta, if you're, you know, whatever your comment is on your friend, or that, you know, if you see them sort of getting stuck in a particular pattern again for the umpteenth time, you know, to always be able to reflect that back in a metaful way. That's the way forward. It's the only way forward. You know, you cannot, if you become critical, that's just not, the Sangha will not thrive that way. And as a Sangha, we need to meet regularly and in harmony. And that we do, and that we certainly do here. So, these are my reflections on Sangha. Not to have to agree with each other, to go beyond likes and dislikes, to always think about the potential in ourselves and the potential in others, whoever they are, in our Sangha, and have a vision of what we can become. Thank you.